Hi, and welcome to Indigenous Americas Part 2. Go ahead and move to slide 1, where we're going to learn about the Mesa Verde Cliff Dwellings. So this is a really interesting architectural site because essentially it kind of anticipates like modern apartment complexes, a densely populated area, and architecture to accommodate that. So on slide 1, the title is Wanted: A Stunning View. So imagine living in a home built into the side of a cliff. And the ancestral Puebloan peoples, formerly known as the Anasazi, did that in some of the most remarkable structures that are still in existence today. Beginning after 1000 CE, they built more than 600 structures into the face of a cliff in the Four Corners region of the United States. So it's the closest to the southwestern corner of Colorado, the northwestern corner of New Mexico, the northeastern corner of Arizona, and then the southeastern corner of Utah. These structures were basically made for a residential function, but some were used for storage and ritual. The dwellings depicted here are located in what today is in southwestern Colorado in the national park known as Mesa Verde. And I think this is about, I want to say it's a couple hours outside of Denver, but keep in mind, there's multiple structures and multiple sites of these cliff dwellings. So the one we're looking at now, it's definitely not the only one. So Verde in Spanish is for green, and then Mesa translates to table in Spanish. But here, Mesa really refers to how flat the top of the mountains are. And that's a common mountain shape or structure in this area of the United States. The most famous residential sites date to the 12th and 13th centuries. The ancestral Puebloans access these dwellings with retractable ladders. So if you are sure-footed and not afraid of heights, you can actually still visit these sites in that same way today, getting on a ladder and walking up to these particular sites. So to access Mesa Verde National Park, you drive up to a plateau along a winding road. The structures are made out of stone, mortar, and plaster, and most remain almost perfectly intact. We often see traces of the people who constructed these buildings. If you look closely into the structures, you can actually see handprints, fingerprints, where people use their hands as tools to pack the mortar and plaster that comprises these walls. So ancestral Puebloans occupied this region from about 450 CE to 1300 CE. So really in that like medieval age. The inhabited region encompassed a far larger geographic area than is defined now by the national park and other residential sites in this area. Not all ancestral Puebloans lived in cliff dwellings. The Yellow Jacket Pueblo was much larger than any site at Mesa Verde. It had 600 to 1200 rooms, and it was estimated that about 700 people likely lived there. In contrast, only about 125 people lived in Cliff Palace, the largest of the Mesa Verde sites. The cliff dwellings are, however, the most well-preserved buildings from this particular time. So go ahead and move to slide 2 for architectural units. The largest of the cliff dwellings, Cliff Palace, has about 150 rooms and more than 20 circular rooms. Due to its location, it's well protected from the elements. The buildings originally ranged from 1 to 4 stories, and some actually hit the top of the natural stone ceiling beneath the cliff. To build these structures, people used stone and mud mortar, along with wooden beams adapted to the natural clefts in the cliff face. The building technique was a shift from the structures built prior to 1000 CE in the Mesa Verde area, which had been primarily made of adobe. And adobe is a type of brick mud. It's made out of clay, and then you add in sand, straw, and sticks to basically reinforce it and make it a much more load-bearing, durable building material. So these stone and mortar buildings, along with the decorative elements and objects found inside them, give us a lot of insight into the lives of the ancestral Puebloan people during the 13th century. At sites like Cliff Palace, families lived in architectural units organized around a kiva. So kivas are circular subterranean rooms. And so basically when you're looking at a kiva, it's like you're kind of looking into a it's not a pool, water doesn't go in it, but it's kind of that effect where you stand near something and then there's like a recess or concave area. So a kiva typically had a wood-beamed roof held up by 6 engaged support columns of masonry, and then also a shelf-like banquet. So other typical features of a kiva included, at the bottom, it would have a fire pit or hearth, a ventilation shaft. I mean, you can imagine there's smoke from the fire. A deflector, which is basically a low wall designed to prevent air drawn from the ventilation shaft from reaching the fire directly. And then also something called a sipapu, which is a small hole in the floor that has a ceremonial purpose. They developed the kivas from the pit house, which is also a circular subterranean room used as a living space. So you can kind of see all these features annotated on the image that's provided on this slide. So a little bit more about kivas. Kivas continue to be used for ceremonies by Puebloan peoples today, though not the kivas within the Mesa Verde National Park that we're looking at. In the past, these circular spaces were likely both ceremonial and residential. If you visit Cliff Palace today, you will see the kivas without their roofs, which we can see in the annotated image, but in the past they would have been covered. The space around the kivas would have functioned as like a small plaza or some type of like community gathering area. Go ahead and move to slide 3, organization of units. So Cliff Palace had connected rooms that fanned out around these plazas, and the connected rooms created a housing unit. One room typically facing the plaza contained a hearth. Family members most likely gathered there. Other rooms located off the hearth were most likely storage rooms with just enough of an opening to squeeze your arm through a hole and grab anything that you would need. Cliff Palace also features some unusual structures, including a circular tower, and archaeologists still aren't sure of the exact use of this particular tower. So when I say Cliff Palace, also keep in mind that I think when we say palace, we think of like a giant mansion dedicated to one person, or sorry, one family to live there. I feel like the Cliff Palace name here just is kind of a designation that connects to like kind of like the majesty and the monumentality of this site. But keep in mind, hundreds of people would have lived here. Okay, go ahead and move to slide 4. We're going to take a look at the painted murals. So the builders of these structures plastered and painted walls, although what remains today is fairly fragmentary. Some murals display geometric designs while others represent animals and plants. So for example, in your image, you're looking at mural 30. Mural 30 is on the third floor of a rectangular tower, and that tower functioned as like a room block. So at Cliff Palace, this mural was painted red on a white wall. The mural includes geometric shapes that are thought to portray a landscape. The mural is similar to murals inside other cliff dwellings at this site, which suggests that maybe the red band at the bottom symbolizes the earth, and the lighter portion of the wall symbolizes the sky. The top of the red band then forms a horizon line that separates the two. We recognized what looks like triangular peaks, maybe it's mountains on a horizon line, and the rectangular element in the sky might relate to clouds, rain, or the sun and moon. The dotted lines might represent cracks in the earth. And so those geometric stylized forms are symbolic of the natural surroundings of this area. The creators of these murals use paint produced from clay, organic materials, and minerals. So for example, the red color came from hematite, which is a red ochre. Blue pigment could be obtained from turquoise or azurite, and then black was often derived from charcoal. So along with the complex architecture and mural painting, the ancestral Puebloan peoples produced black-on-white ceramics and turquoise and shell jewelry. Goods were imported from afar, including shell and other types of pottery, and many of these high-quality objects and their materials demonstrate that these people had a very close connection to the landscape. And so, essentially, your main takeaway from this is that the geometric designs on the murals, and also in the mugs that I have on this picture, demonstrate that concern and that interest in nature and the natural landscape. So slide 5, why build here? And you're looking at an image, it's kind of like a pullback image of the Mesa Cliff dwellings, and you can really see how they correspond with the landscape, and they're almost kind of like hidden in a way. So from 500 to 1300 CE, the ancestral Puebloans who lived at Mesa Verde were sedentary farmers. They cultivated beans, squash, and corn. Corn originally came from what is today Mexico, and at some point during the first millennium of the Common Era, it came north. So originally, most farmers lived near their crops, but this shifted in the late 1100s. People began to move their dwellings to sources of water, and then they would walk or move towards a distant area where they would keep their crops. So why move up a cliff, alcoves away, not necessarily close to water, and definitely not close to your crops? So some theories are that possibly the cliffs provided protection from invaders. And if so, why would they need this kind of defense? Some also theorize that the rock ledges have a ceremonial or some type of spiritual significance. And then a really practical idea, not really a theory, because you can definitely see how this will play out. It provides shade and protection. So during hot months, the cliff ledge would provide a screen from the sun. And then during colder months, it would provide protection from the snow or all the winter elements. So besides the kind of the weather theory, ultimately we're left with educated guesses. The exact reason for building so many cliff dwellings does remain unknown to us. So the cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde were abandoned around 1300 CE. And after all the time and effort it took to build these monumental, beautiful dwellings, why did people leave this area? So Cliff Palace was built during the 12th century, and it was abandoned less than 100 years later. And these are questions that can't be answered conclusively. It's likely that maybe this area experienced a drought, maybe some type of lack of resources, violence, or some combination of these factors. We know, for instance, that there was a drought between 1276 to 1299 CE. These dry periods likely caused a shortage of food and may have resulted in confrontations as resources became more scarce. The cliff dwellings remain, though, a compelling example of how ancestral Puebloans literally carved their existence into the rocky landscape of today's southwestern United States. All right, go ahead and move to slide 6. We're going to take a look at the Great Serpent Mound. So the Great Serpent Mound is literally a man-made formed snake that's 1,300 feet long. So the Great Serpent Mound, you could still see it today, was created in a rural southwestern Ohio area, and it's the largest serpent effigy in the world. So numerous mounds were made by ancient Native American cultures that flourished along the fertile valleys of Mississippi, Ohio, Illinois, and the Missouri rivers over 1,000 years ago. Many were destroyed as people started creating farms around this region to really capitalize on that fertile area. But the ones that exist invite us to contemplate the rich spiritual beliefs of the ancient Native American cultures that created them. The Great Serpent Mound measures approximately 1,300 feet in length and ranges from 1 to 3 feet in height. The complex mound is both architectural and sculptural, and was erected by settled people who cultivated corn, beans, and squash, and also who maintained a stratified society with an organized labor force. Unfortunately, this culture did not leave behind any written records, so we basically have to kind of use conjecture and also compare knowledge we have from other cultures of this area to learn about this particular site. So taking a look at the aerial and close-up views, we can understand that the mound is in relationship to its site, and then we can infer maybe possible intentions of its makers. Go ahead and move to slide 7, supernatural powers. The serpent is slightly crescent-shaped and oriented so that the head is east and then the tail is at the west. And in between the head and the tail, there's 7 winding coils in between. The shape of the head perhaps invites the most speculation. Some scholars read the oval shape as an enlarged eye. Others see a hollow egg or even a frog about to be swallowed by wide open jaws. But perhaps that lower jaw is an indication of an appendage, such as small arms that might imply that the creature could be a lizard instead of a snake. Many native cultures in both North and Central America attributed supernatural powers to snakes or reptiles and included them in their spiritual practices. The native peoples of the Middle Ohio Valley, in particular, did create many snake shapes out of copper sheets. So, because a local culture with many similarities created a lot of snakes, then it would be plausible to understand and identify this shape as a snake. So the mound conforms to the natural topography of this location, which is a high plateau overlooking the Ohio Brush Creek. In fact, the head of the creature approaches a steep natural cliff above the creek. The unique geologic formation suggests that a meteor struck the site from about 250 to 300 million years ago, causing folding bedrock underneath the mound. So here's some more on like some of these celestial hypotheses. So aspects of both the zoomorphic form, remember zoomorphic means it has like animal-like qualities, but it's not necessarily like an identifiable animal. Think back to like the Merovingian looped fibulae. There's little like animal forms we could pick out, but it's not necessarily like a direct representation of one particular animal. And typically zoomorphic has a connection to like decorative forms. So the zoomorphic form and the unusual site have specific associations with worthy of our conversations. And I guess, sorry, I'm like stumbling over my words because I'm struggling with whether I want to use celestial or astronomical. But basically, this is really unusual, and the site does have a connection to astronomy. So the head of the serpent aligns with the summer solstice at sunset, and the tail points to the winter solstice sunrise. So could this mound have been used to mark time or seasons, kind of like what people theorize about Stonehenge? So perhaps this indicates maybe the timing, or maybe it's like a physical way to identify the time of when to plant or when to harvest. It has been suggested that the curves in the body of the snake parallel lunar phases or also align with the two solstices and the two equinoxes. So one way to think of this is like Stonehenge, like an actual physically built site that is used to mark and measure lunar and solar and astrological. Let me look at my notes real quick. I always stumble over that word. Astronomical phenomenon. Some have interpreted the egg or the eye shape at the head to be a representation of the sun. So perhaps even the swallowing of the sun shape could document a solar eclipse. So another theory is that the shape of the serpent imitates the constellation Draco, with a pole star matching the placement of the first curve in the snake's torso from the head. An alignment with the pole star may indicate that the mound was used to determine true north and thus served as some type of compass. Of note is also the fact that Halley's Comet appeared in 1066. Although the tail of the comet is characteristically straight rather than curved, perhaps the mound served in part to mark this astronomical event or similar phenomenon, such as light from a supernova. In a more comprehensive view, the serpent mound may represent a conglomerate of all celestial knowledge known by these native peoples in a single image. However, the big takeaway here is that these particular people had a connection to nature, and by building the site, it proves that these particular people understood, tracked, and found ways to identify solar, lunar, and astronomical phenomenon in the world around them. So slide 8, since we're talking about these people, who built this site? So determining who exactly built this site is difficult. We don't have written records, and this is a matter of ongoing inquiry. A broad answer may lie in viewing the work as being designed, built, and or refurbished over an extended period of time by maybe many different indigenous groups. The leading theory is that the Fort ancient culture is principally responsible for the mound, and that they probably erected it in 1070 CE. This mound-building society lived in the Ohio Valley and was influenced by a contemporary Mississippian culture whose urban center was located at Cahokia in Illinois. The rattlesnake was a common theme among Mississippian culture, and thus it's possible that the Fort ancient culture appropriated this symbol from them, although there's no clear reference to a rattle to identify that this snake effigy would be a rattlesnake. But an alternative theory is that Fort ancient culture refurbished the site in 1070, possibly reworking a pre-existing mound built by the Adena culture, and possibly another culture called the Hopewell culture. Whether the site was built by the Fort ancient peoples or by the earlier Adena or Hopewell cultures, the mound is atypical. It contains no artifacts, and both the Fort ancient and Adena groups typically buried objects inside their mounds. Although there are no graves found inside the Great Serpent Mound, there are burials found nearby, but none of them are the kinds of burials typical for the Fort ancient culture and are more closely associated with the Adena burial practices. Archaeological evidence does not support a burial purpose for the Great Serpent Mound. So the debate continues. Whether this monument was used to mark time, document a celestial event, act as a compass, serve as a guide to astrological patterns, or provide a place of worship to a supernatural snake god or goddess, we may never know with certainty. One scholar has recently suggested that the mound was a platform or a base for totems or other architectural structures that are no longer in existence. Perhaps they were removed by subsequent cultures. All to say, scholarly debate continues. Based on ongoing archaeological evidence and geological research. But without a doubt, the mound is singular and significant in its ability to provide tangible insights into the cosmology and rituals of the ancient Americas. Okay, go ahead and move to slide 9, where you're going to be looking at a very different object. This is from the Eastern Shoshone tribe, and it's a hide painting of the Sun Dance. And it's attributed to an artist known as Kotsiogo, also known as Kotsikoti. So what you're looking at is an animal hide painting. And painting on animal hides is a tradition that is longstanding within the Great Basin and the Great Plains people of the United States. And this includes tribes like the Shoshone, the Blackfeet, the Crow, the Dakota, and the Kiowa. So while the earliest surviving hide paintings date to around 1800, this tradition was undoubtedly practiced much earlier, along with other forms of painting like rock engravings or petroglyphs. So painting, in tandem with oral traditions, functioned to record history. That was its primary purpose. Often artists like Kotsiko, who was also known by his Euro-American name, Kotsikoti, painted on elk, deer, or buffalo hides using natural pigments, like red ochre and chalk, and eventually paints and dyes obtained through trade. Usually artists decorated the hides with geometric or figural motifs. But by the later 19th century, hide artists, like Kotsikoti, began depicting subject matter that affirmed native identity. And the reason they did this is because there was an interest from tourists. This appealed to what the tourists wanted to buy. So the imagery placed on the hide was likely done with a combination of freehand painting and stenciling. Men and women painted on hides, but men usually produced the scenes on teepees, clothing, and shields. Many of these scenes celebrated battles and other biographical details. The Brooklyn Museum's hide painting by Kotsikoti may have functioned as a wall hanging, but it's also been classified as a robe. So go ahead and move to slide 10, where we're going to learn a little bit more about Kotsikoti. So Kotsikoti was a member of the Eastern Shoshone tribe, and he painted many hides in addition to the one we're looking at for the 250. They represent his experiences during a period of immense change for the Shoshone people. During his lifetime, Kotsikoti was placed on the Wind River Reservation in central western Wyoming. So the Wind River Reservation is the size of Rhode Island and Delaware combined, and it had been established by Fort Bridger Treaty of 1868. And the purpose of this was to essentially move the Shoshone outside of the regions that they originally came from, which would be the Great Plains and Plateau regions. And so prior to the placement on the Rind River Reservation, although the Shoshones are connected to those geographic areas I just named, they did move according to the availability of natural resources within those areas. Kadzikode likely created the Brooklyn Museum hide painting for European-American tourists who visited the reservation. It might explain why there is a scene of buffalo hunting, a scene which was thought to be desirable of tourists. Also, the buffalo is an animal associated with many indigenous American tribes of the Great Plains area. The production of the hide would have helped Kadzikode to support himself after the Shoshone were moved to the reservation. With newly established trade markets, an influx of new materials, artists like Kadzikode sometimes produced work that helped support themselves and their families. Go to slide 11, subject matter. So Kadzikode's hide painting combines history with the contemporary moment. It displays elements of several different dances, including the important and the sacred sun dance, and non-religious dances like the wolf dance. The sun dance surrounds a not yet raised buffalo head between two poles or a split tree, and then there's an eagle above that. Men dressed in feather bustles and headdresses, not to be confused with feathered war bonnets, dance around the poles, and this is intended to represent the grass dance. With their arms akimbo and their bodies bent, Kadzikode shows these men in motion. Men participating in this ritual would be refrained from eating or drinking because this type of ceremony would be considered to be sacred. So the sun dance was intended to honor the creator deity for the earth's bounty and to ensure that this bounty would continue. It was a sacred ceremony that tourists and anthropologists often witnessed. However, the United States government deemed it unacceptable and at one point forbid it. The U.S. government outlawed the Sundance until 1935 in an effort to compel Native Americans to abandon their traditional ways. Kadzikode likely included references to the Sundance because he knew a tourist would find the scene attractive and interesting, but he also modified the scene, combining it with the acceptable wolf dance. Maybe with the intent of receiving any type of consequence for depicting anything that would show the sun dance. The wolf dance eventually transformed into the grass dance, which is performed today during powwows and other ceremonial gatherings. The hide painting also shows activities of daily life. Surrounding the sun dance, women rest near a fire and more men on horses hunt buffaloes. Warriors on horses are also shown returning to camp, which was celebrated with the wolf dance. Two teepees represent the camp, with the warriors between them. Some warriors wear feathered war bonnets made of eagle feathers. These headdresses communicated a warrior acted bravely in battle, and so they functioned as symbols of honor and power. A feathered war bonnet was not for anybody. It could only be worn by a powerful warrior. So Kadzikode shows the warriors hunting with bows and arrows while riding. But in reality, Shoshone men had used rifles at this point for some time. Horses were introduced to the Southwest by Spaniards, and some horses made their way to some plain nations throughout the United States, basically through trade. By the mid-18th century, horses became a very essential part of plains culture. So buffaloes were sacred to the plains people because the animals were essential to their livelihood. Some scenes display individuals skinning buffaloes and separating the animal's body parts into piles. All parts of the buffaloes were used, as it was a way to consider of honoring the animal. Because the buffalo was sacred, nothing would be thrown away. So native people would find a way to use every single piece or element of the buffalo. Buffaloes had largely disappeared from this area by the 1880s, but Kadzikode's hide marks these past events and deeds rather than an event that was occurring at the time that this hide was created. And just like a side note from an article that I read about the reservation that Kadzikode and the Shoshone were moved to, according to the New York Times, about 14,000 residents of the Wind River Reservation suffer a crime rate more than 5 times the national average. A life expectancy of someone living at this reservation is only 49 years old, and unemployment is above 80%. So this piece has nothing to do with art history, but I think, like, the fact that Kadzikodo made an object for trade with European Americans, we can see how the introduction of Europeans into America has transformed and impacted the lifestyle of Native peoples. All right, go ahead and move to slide 12 for the bandolier bag. So the bandolier bag is basically a beaded, I don't want to call it a purse because a man could also use this object. It's a bag to hold objects and something worn like an accessory. So when we look at photographs of today, of what we call a bandolier bag, it's nearly impossible to see the thousands of teeny tiny little beads strung together that make up the surface of the bag. This is an object that invites close looking to fully appreciate the process by which these tiny colorful beads create a dazzling object and also showcase remarkable technical skill. So a bandolier bag is often, it was actually based on a bag carried by European soldiers that were armed with rifles. Because think about it, if you're busy holding a rifle, you have to have something that can carry your ammunition and other objects. So bandolier bags were made by different tribes after they saw European soldiers with these bags. And they were predominantly made by tribes that lived across the Great Lakes and prairie regions. Although there's many of these bags in existence, they all have like their own like different decorative qualities. The stylistic differences are a result of personal preference. And then these objects became something that would be passed off or acquired through trade with Europeans and Euro-Americans. So the National Museum of American Indian Art has a great example of a bandolier bag, the one that's in your 250, and it's most likely made by a Lenape artist. The Lenape are part of a Delaware tribe or the First Nation, and they lived along the Delaware River and parts of today what would be New York. So bandolier bags are often large in size and decorated with beads and also ribbon. They're always very colorful. And they're intended to be worn as a crossbody bag with a thick strap crossing a person's chest, and then the bag itself would rest on the hip. These bags were especially popular in the late 19th century in the Eastern or Woodlands region, which comprised parts of what is today Canada and the United States. The Woodlands area encompasses the Great Lakes region and terrain east of the Mississippi River. This enormous geographic area has a long, complex history, including the production of objects we recognize today as art that date more than about 4,000 years back. Bandolier bags were created across this vast expanse of land, and there's many examples of these bandolier bags from the Upper Great Lakes region in Oklahoma. Due to the events and laws like the Indian Removal Act of 1830, the Lenape were forcibly removed from their ancestral lands and relocated to areas of Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and Ontario, Canada. Despite these traumatic relocations, tribes continued to create objects as they had in ancestral lands. And bandolier bags are one example of a continued artistic production. So while men most commonly wore these bags, as you can see in the black and white photo on this slide, women created them. Initially, bandolier bags did not have a pocket, but they were intended to complement men's ceremonial outfits. Men even wore more than one bag on occasion, dressing themselves in a rainbow of colors and patterns. Even those bags with pockets weren't necessarily used to hold objects. So I guess you can think of this as sometimes a bandolier bag did hold objects, but for the most part, its color and its decoration were really meant to be the expression or at the forefront of this object. Women typically produce bandolier bags using trade cloth made from cotton or wool, and it's possible to see the exposed, unembroidered trade cloth underneath the crossbody strap. The bag in the 250 uses animal hide in addition to cotton cloth, combining materials that had long been used among these groups with new materials. Beads and other materials were embroidered on the trade cloth and hide. The tiny glass beads, called seed beads, were acquired from European traders, and they were incredibly prized for their brilliant colors and their shiny, glossy sheen. Glass beads replaced porcupine quill work, which had a long-standing history in the area. Before the use of glass seed beads, porcupine quills were acquired, softened, and dyed. Once they were malleable enough to bend, the quills were woven onto the surfaces of objects. And quill work required different working techniques than embroidering with beads, so people adopted new methods for decorating the surfaces of bags, clothing, and other goods. In addition to glass beads, the bandolier bag from the 250 is decorated with silk ribbons, also procured via trade with the Europeans. Much like glass beads, silk ribbons offered a new material with greater variety of color choices. And you can see that variety of colors by looking at the bandolier bag from the 250. Before the introduction of ribbons, women would sometimes paint the surface of hides in addition to decorating the bag with quill work. Ribbons afforded women the opportunity to produce more variations in the textures and expand the surface of the bag in new ways. Imagine wearing this bag. The bright colors would attract attention, and the sparkle of the beads would reflect the sunlight, and then the ribbons would flutter in the wind or replicate kind of the movement of whoever wore it when they walked. Further animating the surface of the bandolier bag is a wool fringe. And so the wool fringe is typically capped with metal cones that attach the bag to its rectangular pouch. Like the ribbons and beads, the fringe and metal offer more colors and textures to the bag's surface. The designs on the bag are abstract and symmetrical. White beads act as contour lines to help make the designs more visible to the naked eye. On the crossbody strap, we see a design that branches in four directions. Yet notice how the artist has actually made each side slightly different. Some straps display different background colors. Some straps have kind of different colors in between the contour lines. And so that kind of just shows like that variety. There's symmetry and there's balance, but there's some variety in the colors. The small sides of the seed beads also allowed for these decorative geometric forms because it was easier to make curved designs with the seed beads. Using the porcupine quills, it was much harder to make kind of like the curved lines that we see displayed all through this bandolier bag. Now, it is possible that the contrasting colors are intended to be symbolic of the sky and the realm of the underworld. The abstracted designs on the sash may also be read in relation to the cosmos because they branch in four directions, which could relate to the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, and also the division of the terrestrial earthly realm into four quadrants. Go ahead and move to slide 14, prairie style. So the bandolier bag relates to a broader array of objects that demonstrate the prairie style. The artists of the bandolier bag borrowed from older Delaware traditions, as well as those from native peoples who were forcibly relocated. Another bandolier bag, shown on this slide, demonstrates the prairie style clearly in the upper section where the floral motif floats against a dark ground. So you can kind of see it's like in a rectangular horizontal band. You can see what looks like some type of maybe like plant, flower, floral elements, maybe leaves, and then that black background. So the prairie style used colorful glass beads to fashion floral patterns. And once again, remember when you're looking at this object, it's hard to see the beads because they're so tiny and there's so many of them embroidered onto the surface of this object that we kind of just look at it like a flat print. But if you were able to look up close, you could see those tiny beads. The pattern could either be naturalistic flowers or abstract floral designs. And so this is a clear example of a more abstract prairie style because the floral designs don't closely resemble a specific flower that you would see in nature. They're kind of like a reference to that. And the prairie style is a result of different people coming in contact with one another. Native tribes being removed from their ancestral homelands and being moved to a smaller place where they would have that opportunity with contact from other tribes. Floral forms, the use of ribbons and glass beads, not only attest to the transformation in artistic production, but they also testify to the creativity of people as they adapted to new situations. Bandolier bags, as well as other objects and clothing, help to express identities of a group and also social status. In the wake of forest removals and threats to traditional ways of life, Objects like the bandolier bag demonstrate the resilience and continued creativity of groups like the Lenape. So today, bandolier bags are still worn, and they attest to their rich and complex history, as well as their continuing ceremonial cultural functions. So for example, there was an opening of a new museum in Washington, D.C., and people from indigenous tribes wore colorful bandolier bags during opening festivities and ceremonies. Artists continue to create new interpretations of bandolier bags. And essentially, it's kind of transitioned into maybe a bag made out of an industrial material, something more beautiful, rather than having its historical significance at the forefront. All right, go ahead and move to slide 15 for the transformation mask. So transformation masks aren't a decorative object. They're an object used to initiate connection to the spiritual world. So a transformation mask is a type of mask used by indigenous people of the Northwest Coast and Alaska in ritual dances. These masks usually depict an outer depiction of an animal, and typically that animal is some type of apex predator. And then the performer, as they perform in a ceremony, will pull a hidden string, and the mask will open and reveal a human face that's typically intended to be an ancestor. So the Northwest Coast transformation masks manifest transformation. Usually it's an animal changing into a mythical being or an animal becoming a different animal. So masks are worn by dancers during ceremonies. And as I mentioned, they pull a hidden string and in effect they animate and they bring the mask to life through their dance and then also by the movement of opening the mask. So go ahead and move to slide 16. On slide 16, you're going to be watching the opening of a mask. And so as you guys watch the opening of the mask, make sure you click to watch the video. This isn't the mask from the 250, but this is the best video I could find to show you kind of like the impact of the mask opening. Now I will caution you, masks are never intended to be hung on a wall. So the way that you're viewing it isn't really in context. We'll see a little bit of in context later. But I just wanted to get you guys a clear visual. So when the cords are pulled, the eagle's face and the beak split down the center. And then the bottom of the beak gives the impression of the bird kind of like opening up, maybe spreading wings. So you can either press pause as you view this, or you can go ahead and listen to me talk over it. And then when you're done listening, go ahead and go to slide 17. Or sorry, not listening, watching. So slide 17 is transformation and shamanism. So you're looking at a different view of a different transformation mask at the bottom. So in the traditional Native Northwest Coast belief, humans and animals can change forms. A killer whale can turn into a wolf, or a bear can become a human. So at their homes, animals shed their skins and they can reveal that they're a human underneath. And this is kind of something that's part of a lot of Native American myths in this area. Kind of like a shape shifter idea. And transformations happen also when spirit moves between the realms of the universe, from the ocean or the sky to the land, or from the land of the dead back to the land of the living. So shamanism among human beings is a religious spiritual practice where there's a leader called a shaman. And he helps people navigate from the animal to the human world, the human to the spiritual world, kind of like someone who's connected to all places at once. Shamans also heal the sick. They helped bring success in hunting, in fishing, or in war. And they work to create spiritual balance within the community they resided in. By traveling to the spirit world, shamans could call upon spirit leaders to help aid them in recovering lost or afflicted souls. So now I'm going to ask you to pause the podcast. In the corner of this slide, you do have a video that shows the transformation mask actually in context. So how this mask would actually be used in a spiritual context. So go ahead and press pause and make sure you guys watch this video completely. Okay, you should have watched the video of the transformation mask being used in context in a spiritual performance by a shaman. Now we're on slide 18, connecting to ancestors. So the opening and the closing is an important aspect of the transformative effect of the transformation mask. During these ceremonies, like the ones you just viewed, both the ceremony has a variety of aspects to it. It has a spiritual religious aspect, and then also a very theatrical aspect of it, because the spirits of the ancestors are entering into these men in the moment that the mask opens and transforms. The entire mechanism of the mask is rigged in a way so that the performer, while carrying the mask, can manipulate it with his hands, much like a puppet. And typically, the person utilizing the mask would try to mimic the motions and the gestures of the animal depicted in the transformation mask. So when actively performing, a costume of shredded bark hangs from the mask, and that's intended to conceal the body of the person wearing the mask. All right, so go ahead and move to slide 19 for our last artwork in this section. And this is Maria Martinez, the black on black ceramic vessel. So born Maria Antonia Montoya, Maria Martinez became one of the best known native potters of the 20th century. She was an excellent ceramicist, and she had connections to a larger non-native audience. Though she lived at the Pueblo of San Ildefonso, which is about 20 miles north of Santa Fe, New Mexico, her work and her life had a wide-reaching importance to the native art world by reframing native ceramics as a fine art. So I kind of want to rephrase that just so you guys remember it for emphasis. So kind of Maria Martinez's claim to fame is she had a native audience and a non-native audience. And she was able to take a native object and present it as fine art. So in a way, she expands the audience and also elevates the status of the object. Before the arrival of the railroad to the area in the 1880s, pots were used in the pueblos for food storage, cooking, and ceremonies, so just a very pragmatic function. But when inexpensive pots started appearing along rail lines, these practices came in decline because these inexpensive pots were easier to obtain than the pots made by hand by native Puebloans. By the 1910s, Maria Martinez found a way to continue the art by selling her pots to a non-native audience, because this audience found these pots to be beautiful, so they didn't purchase them for their utility function. They purchased them for like aesthetic reasons. They liked the way that they looked. So go ahead and move to slide 20, the process. So Martinez's mastery as a ceramist was noted in her village when she was young. She learned ceramic techniques that were used in the Southwest by watching potters from her area, as well as some of her family members. And so how this process works is all the raw materials had to be gathered and processed carefully, or the final vessel wouldn't be able to fire or bake properly. The clay was found locally, and to make the pottery stronger, the clay was mixed with shards of broken pots that had been pounded into a powder or volcanic ash. When mixed with water, the clay became more